Welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Being sent across the state by our partners at Utah Public Radio, I'm Roger McDonough, and today on the show, President Donald Trump's planned visit to Utah to announce boundary adjustments to the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments, the voter mistakes that resulted in thousands of ballots in Utah being rejected in the November election, the tax deal Real Salt Lake secured with Salt Lake County, and the experiences of women in Utah politics who have suffered sexual harassment. Those and other stories in the lineup today. Joining me to discuss these stories, Salt Lake Tribune government reporter Courtney Tanner is with us. Welcome back, Courtney.
Good morning.
Government reporter Lee Davidson is with us as well. Hello and good morning, Lee.
Hi.
Tribune news columnist Robert Gerke is with us as well. Good morning, Robert.
Good morning.
And on the phone we have Salt Lake Tribune Washington Bureau Chief Thomas Burr. Thanks to you, Tommy, for being here.
Of course. Good morning.
And we invite you to join us with your questions and comments. Weigh in at sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or you can call us at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. I will start with Thomas Burr, Washington Bureau Chief. And Tommy, last week, actually it was a couple of weeks back, we knew that President Donald Trump was coming to Utah to make an announcement about our national monuments. The details at that time were a bit unclear, but you were able to get a few more of the details about this visit. What do we know about Trump's coming to Utah? When and where is he going to appear?
Sure. There's some things we don't know that are public yet, but what we do know is that the president is going to fly in on Monday to Salt Lake City.
Okay.
As we understand it, as I understand it, he's going to fly in to the Salt Lake City airport, go tour Welfare Square with leaders of the LDS Church, and then head to the state capitol where he'll make this announcement on Grand Staircase and Bears Ears National Monuments in front of supporters. I don't believe at this time there's going to be any public events.
Mm-hmm.
I assume there will be some protests scheduled outside of the places there, but
yeah.
Nothing public, but the big announcement will be at the state capitol.
And Tommy, you also reported, if I'm not mistaken, that Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke will be coming back to Utah, joining the president on this trip?
He will. So he's going to be, I'm sure, right by his side or maybe introducing the president. Zinke, of course, was the one who, as ordered by the president, put together this review of all monuments designated since 1996. And this is the, you know, kind of crowning event after that review has been done for the president to actually say what he's going to do with those recommendations.
Hmm. And as you said, those recommendations are the purpose of this visit, and we're expecting the reduction of both the Bears Ears and Grand Staircase Escalante National Monuments. There are five Native American tribes who will then pretty much immediately take action to try and stop whatever it is that the president announces, correct?
Yes, and they may not be alone, but from what I understand, the five tribes who were kind of behind pushing this monument, who have been doing this, actually working on this for a generation, but actually, you know, got together and were able to get the monument done this last year, have a lawsuit ready to go. They're not sure whether they'll file that in Salt Lake City or here in D.C. Or somewhere else. I think those are the only two would actually make sense. But they're ready to go, and I don't think they'll be alone. You have environmental groups like the Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance who may also file a suit somewhere, and possibly others.
And this is, the Hopi Nation, Navajo Nation, Ute Mountain Ute Tribe, Pueblo of Zuni, and the Ute Indian Tribe. They are the groups making up the Bears Ears Intertribal Coalition. And you, in your reporting, said that their lawsuit is going to be about the president's action violating the Constitution's separation of powers. The idea here is that this is Congress's domain, that the Antiquities Act allows for the designation of a monument, but that there's no undeclaration or unprotecting of lands spelled out in that act, correct?
Yeah, in fact, there's the two different sides right there. So if you're in this White House or the Interior Department, you say, well, the Antiquities Act gives us the power to create, so inherently we have the power to uncreate, to take it back. The environmental community, the tribes, say, no, that's not spelled out in the statute. It doesn't say you can take it back, and that would be Congress's purview. So, yes, the separation of powers issue, which is, by the way, the same kind of lawsuit that's been filed over the president's the Muslim ban,
right.
So-called Muslim ban, and other executive orders.
A quick reminder to listeners to join us with your questions and comments. You can call us at 801-355-8255 or comment at sltrib.com. The push for Bears Ears to be declared a national monument was led by this intertribal coalition. The fight against amending it, at least in part, will be pushed by this same group. Has the president addressed Native American opposition to the action he's going to take, Tommy?
No, and I mean, interested to see what he says on Monday about that. You know, there has been some concern about President Trump's relationship with Native Americans. Going back to, you know, soon into office, he okayed the Keystone Pipeline over lands that that tribal nations said were sacred to them and that would destroy cultural artifacts. He's repeatedly called Senator Elizabeth Warren Pocahontas, which some see as a racial slur. And now you have him taking away protections on areas that Native people see as very sacred to them as well. It's created somewhat of a tense situation there.
Hmm. We have a comment from someone who called in from Vernal. This is Tom, who says, if Trump wins the Bears Ears challenge in court, Tom is worried about what is going to happen to other monuments and national parks in the future. And he thinks that these protected lands will then become a kind of political football. I don't know if that's a question for you, Tommy, but is that a risk?
Yeah, well, sure. Let's start with this. National parks are created by Congress, so only Congress can change those. That's pretty clear already. National monuments, these may not be the only two that the president announces changes to. There was Gold Butte in Nevada, where that President Obama named around the same time as Bears Ears. That could be on the chopping block. There could be others. And he may not wait for the court challenge to settle this dispute. You know, court challenges could go on for quite a while, years almost. So in the meantime, these lands will be managed, depending on if a judge has an injunction or not. But yes, there could be many others that are affected. I think there were six that were on the recommendations to be changed from Secretary Zinke, so there could be more.
Okay, and here in Utah, again, we've heard that the Grand Staircase Escalante National Monument is slated to be shrunk by half or more, Bears Ears by somewhere around 90%, if I'm not mistaken. Those are, I guess, the rumors, and we'll know for certain on Monday, correct, Tommy?
Yeah, so there's a couple. What we see is, our reporting has previously said this, that Bears Ears will be around 200,000 acres. Grand Staircase will be shrunk by about 1 million acres. And the Washington Post got some documents and maps yesterday kind of showing what would happen there. The Interior Department pushed back and said they were old maps and not current. But as it looks right now, the two monuments will be kind of broken into five. So Bears Ears will be shrunk down 200,000 acres, leaving a lot of areas that Native Americans wanted protected, unprotected by a monument status. And Grand Staircase will be kind of split into a few different monuments as well.
Okay. And you mentioned that the president's going to be here for just one day. He's going to visit. Welfare Square, which is the Mormon Church's center of charity to the poor. I'd actually like to bring in news columnist Robert Gerke on this. And Robert, the president hasn't had the most welcome embrace from members of the LDS Church. I'm thinking especially after he said some demeaning, derogatory things about women in that leaked Access Hollywood video that came out during the campaign.
Yeah.
But also because of the president's inflammatory statements during his campaign about Muslims. Has the LDS Church become, over time, more accepting of the president?
Well, no, not really. I mean, his approval rating in Utah has still been under 50% since he took office. There was actually a new poll out today that said it's been hovering right around 47%. The LDS Church has a lot of problems with him, and it's not just the Muslim ban; it's also the DACA program, which the church leaders took a pretty unusual step in issuing a statement during the campaign, condemning harsh comments the president had or the candidate at the time had made about Muslims. And so, it's an uncomfortable relationship. I mean, I think, Utahns and Mormon Utahns are typically vote Republican overwhelmingly. They're the most reliably Republican voting bloc in the United States. Mm-hmm. But there's some unease with President Trump. And I think maybe he can do something to sort of, kind of come to terms, soften that resistance a little bit. But he's not one who typically does much to soften his people's feelings toward him. You know, and there's also been this thorny relationship between President Trump and Mitt Romney, who is, you know, probably the most prominent Mormon politician, along with Senator Hatch, maybe, in the United States. And so, yeah, it's a tense relationship.
I was just this week, the president retweeted some anti-Muslim videos that a fringe British group, an extremist group there, tweeted out that was condemned by the British Prime Minister, Theresa May, and by many others, including some human rights groups, some of them calling it a kind of incitement to violence against a specific religious group. And again, looking at the broader kind of religious coalition that exists in the United States and the supportive relationships between faiths, will that make this visit with LDS church officials kind of more awkward, I guess? I don't know.
Yeah, I think that may be a little bit far afield. But I mean, I think, you know, it's a gesture. It's something that presidents typically do when they do come to Utah, is visit with the LDS church leaders. During the campaign, we saw a couple of the candidates who toured Welfare Square. So that's not that unusual. But I think it's, you know, it's a gesture, a goodwill gesture, I guess, on the president's part to have the meeting, and for the church leaders to host the president. No. So, you know, we'll see how that goes and whether it actually changes the dynamic in that relationship.
And again, meeting with Mormon. Oh, Tommy, go
on the wall there. It's only we could be a fly on the wall for that visit. I don't know how much press coverage we're going to get.
From inside.
You know, last time Obama was in town, he met with church leaders, but was pretty much closed press.
Yeah.
So I would love to see what we're going to hear from them.
Right. And again, meeting with Mormon church officials is kind of the add-on to this visit. He's coming out, as we said, to try to adjust the boundaries of two Utah national monuments. Thomas Burr, is the president then just turning around and flying right back to Washington? You said he's not staying overnight.
He's not staying overnight. I believe so at the moment. I haven't heard of any other stops. Usually when a president flies west like that, they're going to make a stop in, you know, Denver or Phoenix or something. But we haven't heard anything yet so far about that. And the White House has been very mum about the details on the trip. But he's definitely in and out of Salt Lake City. It could be only a few hours he's going to spend there. I guess if you're a driver in Salt Lake City, you're probably thankful the motorcade won't be blocking every street.
Right. There are protests planned against the president's national monument action. There's a rally this weekend at the Capitol in advance of this visit, for example.
Yes, on Saturday, it sounds like there's several groups that have organized a rally at the Capitol. And again, I assume there'll be some stuff on Monday as well. But Saturday's been the big push. Last I checked on Facebook, there were like 2,000 or more people who said they were going to attend. 10,000 said they were interested. So it could be a big rally.
Okay. Robert Gerke, I didn't get your comments on just the action that's going to be taken. We talked a little bit about Trump meeting with the Mormon church officials. But in terms of what the president is expected to do when he's here, beside Interior Secretary Ryan Zinke, Utah as a state seems like maybe it's a bit divided on that action.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. I mean, it's interesting that he's going. I mean, it's no surprise, right? We've expected this for months, if not almost a year now, that this was going to be coming down. And you know, we reported back in April that about 200,000 acres was what they were looking at for Bear's Ears. The Grand Staircase one is interesting, is unique, because if the maps that the Washington Post got are correct, and my understanding is that they are pretty close to what it's going to look like, they're carving out a huge swath of the coal resources in there that then would be available for leasing. You know, and so that seems to be going what they're going after in Grand Staircase. In Bear's Ears, there's really not the same sort of mineral resources, so they're shrinking that one. The rallying cry on this whole thing has been, let's listen to the locals. And unfortunately, you know, I don't know that that's really been the case. I mean, if you look at the recommendations both from the state on the Bear's Ears Monument and the from the counties on Grand Staircase, they don't really track very closely with what the administration is recommending here. And, you know, and then you have the tribal coalition, who has been adamantly in support of this. And I don't know if their input's really being considered fully either. I mean, the Navajo Nation, for example, each chapter house has taken votes on this in the last couple months and overwhelmingly supports keeping Bears ears, along with these other tribes that have also supported it in the past. So if the objective here is listen to the locals, it doesn't appear that that's what the outcome has been. But ultimately, like I said, we knew this was coming. It's going to end up in court. And ultimately, I guess the only opinion that's going to matter are these judges who are going to hear the cases.
Okay. And Robert Gerke, news columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune there, expressing his opinion. Some interesting days ahead here in the state of Utah. And Thomas Burr, Salt Lake Tribune, Washington Bureau Chief, I know that we have got to let you get to other things, but thank you for joining us and for this update this morning.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Of course. We need to take a quick break, but when we come back, we'll turn to the sexual harassment stories of some women in Utah politics and more. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stick around.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members, and support for science reporting on Utah Public Radio comes from the Utah State University Ecology Center, providing training opportunities for today's science communicators, one story at a time.
As you know, President Trump will be in Utah on Monday to announce reductions to Grand Staircase, Escalante, and Bears Ears National Monuments in Utah. Speculation is that those will be drastic reductions in size. I've already gotten a couple of emails and know that you will likely want to respond to these moves. We're going to devote Access Utah on Tuesday to this topic. We'll have some guests, but mostly we want to hear from you. You can email us right now to upraccess@gmail.com, and you can call in during the hour, 9 to 10 on Tuesday.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Christmas with the American Festival Chorus and Orchestra with Gentry, the Gentleman Trio, featuring the Cash Children's Choir and the Westminster Bell Choir, Thursday, December 7th at 7:30 p.m. in the USU Danes Concert Hall.
To Behind the Headlines, I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined by Salt Lake Tribune government reporters Courtney Tanner and Lee Davidson and news columnist Robert Gerke. This is our Friday news wrap-up. You can join us with your questions and comments at either sltrib.com or the KCPW Facebook page, or call us up at 801-355-8255. And to Courtney Tanner now. Courtney, you wrote an article this week about the experiences of some women in Utah politics who have experienced sexual harassment on the job. These include instances of inappropriate kissing or touching, sexually suggestive remarks, and so on. For example, you spoke with Enid Green Mickelson, who during her time in Congress, representing Utah's 2nd Congressional District, had an encounter that left her more than a little uncomfortable, and this was on the U.S. House floor, right?
That's right. So she was new to Congress and decided she'd walk across the House floor to say hi to the subcommittee chairman, and he just kind of lurched forward and kissed her on the lips, and she was a little bit surprised, obviously. About this behavior. Yep.
And that was just one of a number of examples that the Tribune compiled of Utah women in politics who experienced harassment. State Representative Sophia DiCario and Cheryl Allen recalled sexually suggestive comments made to them in professional, government settings. Representative Patrice Arendt talked about harassing comments from various men when she was an intern for the Utah governor, and later inappropriate touching when she was an associate general counsel to the legislature. Jenny Wilson, who is the Salt Lake County Councilwoman who's now running for Senate, heard derogatory remarks from some men during her time in D.C., and on and on and on it goes, probably unsurprisingly to anybody who's been paying attention to the news at all in the past little while. The general theme here, though, Courtney, was that this remains a problem.
That's right. So obviously you've seen all of these cases nationally in Washington and Hollywood and all these state houses now and in the media. But these women are coming forward and saying, this happens here in Utah, too. Don't forget that.
Right. It's not the only place. Representative Mia Love, in your reporting, also spoke about instances of sexual harassment in Congress, not necessarily her own, although she did say that some men had come close to crossing a line with her on occasion. But Representative Love wants to see some things change when it comes to how allegations are handled in Congress, meaning when the allegation is against a member of Congress or a staff member of a member of Congress. What is she advocating for?
She wants the rules changed for victims to file complaints. So she wants more transparency in that process, kind of along with Representative Chris Stewart. This passed, but she had called for the House members to be required to take this anti-harassment training that did pass this week. And she doesn't want members of Congress to be able to spend taxpayer money to settle these claims.
And that's how it happened before, is that a settlement would occur and it would be secret, first off. But then the settlement that was paid out to a victim would come from taxpayers' dollars, not from the perpetrator of the act.
That's right. So everything was handled confidentially. If you got a settlement, a victim wouldn't be able to name who their alleged harasser was.
Yeah. You know, sorry, I'm losing my voice here for a quick moment. But Chris Stewart, as you said, is pushing for that when there is a sexual harassment allegation against a member of Congress, that secrecy that you just described won't continue to occur. There's a mandatory non-disclosure agreement. If there's a settlement reached between a member of Congress and their accuser, Stewart says, let's just get rid of that altogether.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's shift over for a moment to Robert Gierke, who is the columnist. Gierke, big names in Hollywood, media, government, as Courtney Tanner has been reporting here, being implicated for sexual assault and for harassment. These are largely men. And right now, what we've been seeing happening, it feels kind of like a watershed moment in American history, kind of cultural reckoning. But it's probably just the tip of a much bigger iceberg under the surface.
Well, I think what it shows is that there's been a pattern that's gone on for far too long without getting the attention it deserves and that it demands. I think the common thread between, as you mentioned, Hollywood and politics and just the workplace in general is the power dynamic, and people in Washington are obsessed with the power, but there's an inequity in the power in a lot of situations, and they feel like they can perpetrate this abuse and this harassment against these women. And I think it's good that it's coming to light. As you mentioned, I think it is the tip of the iceberg. I think the fact that so many people in Washington, in Hollywood, and other walks of life have these stories that this has happened to them kind of shows that how pervasive it's been. I think the notion of not, when it came to light that Congress had paid out millions of dollars over, for scores of settlements over the years, and we don't know who's doing the harassing and whose victims are. I mean, I think that's something that the public should know. And I don't think the taxpayers should be on the hook for the bad behavior of members of Congress or their staffs. So I think what Representative Stewart's proposing and what others have proposed is right on the money. I mean, it came to light that John Conyers had a pattern of this and has stepped down from his committee chairmanship. He's being that he resign from Congress. And this is John Conyers is an institution. He's been in Congress a long time. But, the behaviors, as you mentioned, it's a reckoning in a way. And it's long overdue.
Courtney, the women who you spoke to here in Utah, the Utah politicians who had these experiences with harassment, was there, I don't know if you would have gotten to this, but was there any sense that, coming from then, that what we're seeing now, at the cultural level, this moment that we're having here, is that things might be getting better as a result?
There was kind of a mixed response on this. So Enid Mikkelson is kind of worried that nothing's changed since she was in Congress in 1995. And that's a long time if nothing's changed. But other people said, maybe with these conversations that are coming out, things will change. And there's a possibility for that.
How about the difficulty of getting people to go on record and have their stories told? Was that a factor in this reporting of the number of women? I mean, there were 19 women that the Tribune spoke to?
13, yeah. 13. I think that's an important thing with this discussion is that, these women came forward and talked about some of the harassing comments they faced, but this is just the tip of the iceberg. There are so many women that we didn't talk to or that didn't want to talk about what had happened to them on the record. It's like Gierke said, this is a power thing. They fear any kind of consequence that would come out of talking about this.
Courtney Tanner, thank you for this reporting. We have just an hour of time to get through various stories here, and we're going to move on to more from this past week's news. And on that point, we'll turn to somebody who we haven't heard from yet, which is Tribune government reporter Lee Davidson, who, among other things this week, covered a story about voting problems in the special election in Utah's 3rd congressional district, or maybe I should say problems that voters had as opposed to voting problems. Lee, a couple of thousand ballots disqualified. It's a sizable amount, or actually a chunk of that had to do with human error. Is that accurate to say?
Almost all of it had to do with human error.
Okay.
A lot of different types of errors. Some people sent in their ballots without sending in the ballot. They sent in an empty envelope. Others sent them in too late. They have to be postmarked the day before the election. 10 people attempted to vote for someone who is dead.
That'll happen.
Is empty envelopes, could it be a protest, or is that just I forgot to put my ballot in?
It appears to be just I forgot to vote.
Okay.
There were a couple of thousand votes, actually about 2,500, which comes out to about 1.5% of those who attempted to vote had problems, didn't have their ballots counted.
And you said that a really big chunk of the so-called spoiled ballots were because people sent in their mail-in ballots too late, about 1,000 ballots there.
About 1,000 of them, and almost all of them in Utah County. This was the first time in a general election that Utah County has voted by mail. And state officials think that there's a learning curve when you do that, and that a lot of them just simply didn't realize they had to mail it the day before the election, or on the day of the election they have to vote in person or drop off their mail ballot at an in-person voting center.
Some bugs in the system maybe for now, but a learning curve. A disproportionate number of those mailed in late, and actually a disproportionate number of the disqualified ballots in Utah County. Any rhyme or reason for why that was the case?
Again, first time they're voting by mail, and Utah County is also kind of the larger portion of that particular district, so more people voting there, some more problems.
Right.
And Utah County's had some problems in general with elections.
All right, there's a history there. Robert Gerke, just focusing for a quick moment on the mail-in ballots, and if you mail them in a day late, they don't get counted. Should there be a kind of grace period, or is it hard and fast deadline? If you don't get it in, it's done.
I think you need a hard and fast deadline, and it's like if I forget to go vote on Tuesday, I don't get to vote on Wednesday. There are deadlines and there are consequences, and I think. My big idea here is I think Utah County doesn't get to vote anymore. They can't. Every election, they screw it up somehow. I mean, usually it's the clerk's fault. They've sent general election ballots to Republican voters or to Democratic voters. One year they left voting machines unsecured in a lobby. It's a perpetual problem. They just can't seem to get it right. And then when they do have the elections, they're returns are always 2-3 hours late. Everybody's waiting on them. I just think, maybe Utah County, proves that democracy doesn't work.
Robert Kirky's dangerous ideas to disqualify Utah County altogether.
He's wearing red today also, if that means anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Lee, he's drinking from a Utah Utes cup, too, as we sit here.
He's partisan. Lee Davidson, another reason for ballots being disqualified was that the signature on the ballot didn't match the signature on file. 560 ballots were disqualified this way. How does that happen? Somebody else is signing the
ballot? It can be, my grandma can't vote very easily for herself, so I'll just sign it for her and send it in.
Yeah.
John Dougal, the state auditor, said he was a person who had a problem with that because he said he actually changed the way he signs his signature a few years ago for a variety of reasons, and it didn't match the one on file. And so he had to go in and change his signature on file.
Yeah, the way they do this is really kind of fascinating because they have a digital comparison, and if it doesn't match, it gets spit out. Then they do a visual comparison, and they determine whether or not it looks like they have certain criteria that they score it on. And if the signature looks enough like it, they'll let it go. And then if it doesn't match, then they'll send a letter to the person saying, there's a question about your signature. Can you come in and provide additional proof? So they really go to great lengths to make sure every ballot that's cast is counted. There are problems when people, break a hand or change their signature, or sometimes if they get old, they get tremors and so forth. And so, there are problems that arise, but they do go to great lengths to make sure they get counted.
Okay. And then, Lee, some ballot, you mentioned people voting for someone who was deceased, but there's also a number of ballots that were discarded because the voter was supposedly deceased. All of those occurred in Utah County as well. What gives? Why is this people who maybe did vote and then died, or is it?
It can be both. I think they raised the question at the canvas, the official vote count, but they didn't get into the details, so I don't know. But it could be that someone had voted and then died, and they pulled that vote, or it could be that someone died and someone in the family thought, gee, Grandpa would have voted this way. I'm just going to sign it and send it in.
Got it. Well,
it was caught.
The bulk of, I mean, that was something like 10 ballots that were discarded that way.
Yeah, not a lot. But
the bulk was for other issues. Some of this, though, is obviously, or would seem, just that voters need better education about deadlines, about how to vote. Is that right?
Put your ballot in the envelope before you send it, you know.
Okay. Well, yeah. I think this is significant, too, though, because so many of the counties now have gone to vote by mail. Mm-hmm. And it seems to be the direction that all of the counties, the entire state's going, is to vote by mail. And so these are glitches. These are problems that we've got to work out before we get too far down this road, I think.
Lee Davidson, go ahead.
I would mention that vote by mail seems to have raised the voter turnout significantly.
That's right.
And there are 7 counties that voted in this congressional election. The 2 that had the lowest turnout were the 2 that still used in-person voting. And that's been a trend in a lot of elections recently.
It's always kind of bothered me, too, though, because when you have counties that don't do vote by mail in the same election that counties that do have vote by mail, it seems like the counties that don't have vote by mail are in getting disenfranchised almost in some way. They don't have the same opportunities to vote. Their voter turnout is lower. Their representation, the percentage of the sway that they have in that election gets diminished a little bit. So I think we need to go to a uniform system before too long to make sure that everybody gets the same voice in the elections.
Well, and the new counties that come on board will have to go through the same learning curve.
Yeah.
What about the idea of digital, voting digitally, Robert Kerr?
I mean, there's some talk about it. Voting security is a problem. There's some discussion, even with the voting machines that the state is in the process of purchasing, there's questions about security and the ability to hack it. And I think when we saw with Russian activity in the last election, the notion of a hacked election is something to be considered, that we need to be aware of. But there's some interesting technology, too, the security technology. I don't know if you're familiar with blockchain. Mm-hmm. It's one of the things that people are talking about now is that this blockchain technology that creates a ledger of all of every activity could provide the level of security that would make online voting a possibility in the future.
This is the technology behind Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Lee Davidson, just before we go to a break, which we need to do here in just a moment, the 2,419 invalidated votes from this election, would they have made a difference in this particular race? Would it have changed who we sent to Congress?
Not at all. The winning margin was huge, and so it wouldn't have made a difference.
Okay. Well, let's head to another quick break. Next up, we will take a look at the big property tax break Rail Salt Lake has been getting from Salt Lake County for the past 5 years, kind of under the radar. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. We'll be right back.
As you know, President Trump will be in Utah on Monday to announce reductions to Grand Staircase, Escalante, and Abarazir's National Monuments in Utah. Speculation is that those will be drastic reductions in size. I've already gotten a couple of emails and know that you will likely want to respond to these moves. We're going to devote Access Utah on Tuesday to this topic. We'll have some guests, but mostly we want to hear from you. You can email us right now to upraccess@gmail.com, and you can call in during the hour, 9 to 10 on Tuesday.
This week, President Trump decided to insult 2 important Democrats right before a meeting with them so they wouldn't come, and he got a photo op with their empty chairs. So, since we're doing our show in Seattle this week, those people are flannel-wearing, latte-sipping slackers with moss under their collars. I'm sure this means we're winning, right? I'm Peter Sagal. Join us as we talk to filmmaker Greta Gerwig in the Emerald City on this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Lee Davidson, Courtney Tanner, and Robert Gerke. Join us with your comments and questions at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. Lee Davidson, as I mentioned in the teaser before we went to the break, Real Salt Lake, the soccer franchise located in Sandy, has been getting a big property tax break from Salt Lake County for the past 5 years. But it's a tax break that it sounds like wasn't all that well debated when it was put into place and has maybe kind of gone unnoticed. What it really is a devaluation of the stadium's land value. But that, of course, equates to a property tax reduction. I don't know where to jump into the story. Maybe tell us about how and when this tax break happened.
It's all kind of fascinating. It all happened very quietly and wasn't noticed for years until now. essentially it happened so quietly, in fact, that the people who approved it, the Salt Lake County Council, swear they don't remember the vote. Mm-hmm. They look at the old minutes and things, and sure, they voted on it, but it didn't really get any debate at all. And anyway, let's back up a little bit.
Okay.
The stadium was built for $110 million, and it was it originally was taxed for about that amount. Del Loy Hansen later became a part owner of the team and eventually became the full owner of the team. He happens to be a land developer, and he went to the county and said, I think this thing is overvalued. Please look at it. The county assessor people said they did, and they dropped the value by about half, which also dropped the taxes by about half.
Right.
And in recent years, they've saved more than $5 million in taxes that would have gone to local government, school districts, water districts, et cetera. No one noticed it. Hmm. However, Sandy cut a special deal to kind of try to keep them whole. And that's a little bit of a fascinating tale, too.
I was going to say, hold on, before you get into that, I mean, at first, Sandy objected to the idea of reducing this tax, of reducing the value of the land, by saying that to make payments on the bonds issued to pay mm-hmm. to build the stadium, the value needed not to be reduced for them to be able to keep making those payments.
In fact, they had made an agreement with RSL originally saying, well, we're going to issue some bonds to help build the stadium. The way we're going to pay off those bonds is we're going to use our share of the property tax that will come from the stadium. And so you don't get to try to lower the value of the stadium, or if you do, we need to hear about it.
That opposition went away, though.
Well, yeah, they heard about it, and they immediately filed a protest with the county saying, you know, we have this deal, we're going to fight it. So Del Loy Hansen went to meet with Sandy Mayor Tom Dolan and essentially said, if you won't fight it, we'll work out a deal where we'll give you about the same amount of money every year that you would have gotten from your taxes to cover the bond payments. He went to the city council, we found, through minutes, and they went along with that. And then the county withdrew their opposition to the tax cut, and the tax cut occurred. Now, the deal was also kind of weird. They didn't sign a contract saying, we're going to give you $75,000 a year to make up for the lost property taxes. Instead, it said, you know, we made this deal that we were going to provide 1,000 parking places within 5 minutes of the stadium. We never did that, so we're going to pay you $75,000 a year. So they said it was for parking, not the lost taxes. The Sandy officials now say, no, it was really for the taxes. We just worded it that way because our bond lawyers said that was the better way to do it. And so it's all just kind of weird. And on top of that, Sandy Mayor Tom Dolan, who lost his election last month, declined to talk to us about this deal. RSL and Del Loy Hansen also declined to talk to us about that deal.
Who, I'm sorry to boil down a lot of hard investigation and deep reporting you did, that you must have done to get to the bottom of this story. Who, to this question, but who has that lost tax revenue conceivably hurt? And then who, you know, directly has the tax break benefited? Obviously, the franchise itself.
Well, the tax break helped RSL.
Yeah.
Like we said, about $5 million through the years. And to put that into focus, that's about 70% of the team's guaranteed player payroll last year.
70%, yeah.
The ones it could have hurt were the tax entities that would get that money. Canyon School District, a variety of water districts, Salt Lake County Library. And to make up for the loss of money that would have come from RSL, of course, other people may pay a little bit more in property tax.
Meaning adjustments could have been made for other people by the council or by
whoever. Everyone else would pay a little bit more since you're losing
Revenue source. Mm-hmm. And as you said, the Salt Lake County Council doesn't remember okaying the tax the break deal, this devaluation. Have they gone back and looked at it and figured out what happened?
Yeah. These meetings, they often approve hundreds and hundreds of revaluations. In that meeting, there was nearly 800. And they vote in large blocks. It's not like they're going through every single one and looking at it. Mm-hmm. However, they found that the assessor did provide a sheet showing the largest ones, the top 20, anything that where the valuation changed more than $250,000. And this one was changing by $44 million, and it dwarfs everything else on the list. But the minutes don't show any kind of comments or questions raised about it.
A weird thing not to remember. Robert Gerke, something maybe seems a little amiss here.
Can I bring some outrage on this? This thing just stinks to high heaven because, first off, Deloy Hansen gets a sweetheart deal. I mean, Sandy taxpayers, county taxpayers end up footing part of the bill to build this stadium. And the notion being that, you know, they're going to get paid back with the property taxes. They're going to be economic development here. And then they turn around and get this tax break that ends up putting voters on the hook again. So they're paying for it up front, and then they're paying off the bonds with their higher property tax rates because Deloy Hansen, who's one of the wealthiest people in the state, who owns more land, more property than just about anybody in the state, is getting this deal from the county. And you know, I think voters of Salt Lake County and voters in Sandy deserve some answers from Tom Dolan and Deloy Hansen because they're the ones who are taking it, you know, both coming and going on this. So it's a shady deal, and I think it sort of should be a warning about getting the public involved in building sports stadiums in the future.
Well, it's a debate that happens all around. Go ahead, Lee Davidson. Yeah,
I just forgot to mention one other thing. RSL got this tax break because they claimed they were losing money.
All right,
and that affected how the stadium is valued. At the same time, Sandy City Council went along with this thing saying, gee, the team's finally making money. Let's help them, you know, continue that. And so what happened there, and it'd be interesting to see if the team says it is still losing money or making money now.
I guess I'm wondering, can we determine whether or not the team was losing or making money during these years and say yes or no?
The documents given to the county are confidential, and so we can't get at them. And be up to the team now to say how they're doing financially.
How about in terms of political repercussions, Robert Gehrke? I'm thinking of, you know, Salt Lake County Mayor Ben McAdams. He was in office, yes, at this time. Jenny Wilson, who is running for Senate, is on the Salt Lake County Council. I can't remember her tenure.
Yeah.
But will this affect their campaigns?
Now, Lee can correct me if I'm wrong on this, but I don't believe the county mayor votes on the equalization board, so it probably won't blow back on him. Tom Dolan obviously already lost his election, so it probably won't be an issue for him. But you know, I think the other council members probably have some questions they need to answer. As Lee mentioned, they don't remember voting for it, but a $44 million tax cut is not something that you should just rubber stamp without batting an eye. And I think there's an obligation if you're sitting on that board of equalization. The whole purpose of being there is to make sure you're a watchdog, and these guys just were asleep on the job.
Well, it's a really fascinating story, a quiet deal, a big chunk of money, and a long article where you can read all about it in the Salt Lake Tribune from this past Sunday. Check it out at sltrib.com. And Lee Davidson, thanks for your reporting on this. In the last few minutes that we have, I want to turn to yet another story that you reported on, Lee. It's a story on the massive growth and the massive amount of money that could be needed to keep the Point of the Mountain area from heading down some less than desirable paths when it comes to development. And first off, when we say Point of the Mountain, Lee Davidson, for people listening a little further away, we're talking about the border between Salt Lake and Utah counties, out at the site of the Utah State Prison, you know, around there roughly, where it is currently.
Right. It's kind of a bottleneck of land. And actually, this study looks a little bit more broadly than just the Point of the Mountain. It looks at everything from Sandy down to Lehigh, and from one mountain range to the other mountain range. But anyway, state is projecting all kinds of growth there. And they say that to prevent a disaster, they really need to spend a lot of money to improve transportation mostly, but education and other sorts of infrastructure and facilities to the tune of maybe an extra $11 billion between now and 2050. It's a lot of money.
This is the result of a study you mentioned. Who carried out this study and who put together this study?
As the state decided to close the prison, they created something called the Point of the Mountain Development Commission, and they contracted with a group called Envision Utah to try to envision what the area could look like under various scenarios. And they've come up with five different ones, depending on how much money people want to spend. And they're letting people vote on them online right now. If you go to pointofthemountainfuture.org, you can look at it and vote.
And the kind of choice they're presenting is cheaper, not very smart growth, or something else. I mentioned,
there's a whole spectrum of doing only what's already planned, which they say would kind of lead to a disaster, to doing the Chrysler version, spending everything that they could possibly think of that they think would be just a nice future, and everything in between. Some of the things they're proposing are interesting, like they are proposing perhaps extending tracks, light rail, from Draper to Orem through the prison site, double tracking the Front Runner commuter train so that you can double the frequency, getting rid of fares for mass transit so more people would ride it, widening freeways in the area, the Mountain View Corridor and I-15, adding more highways like another major highway to parallel Redwood Road, and encouraging higher density housing so more people would live in the area and not have to drive in from other areas to jobs, new jobs there.
Okay. Part of this has to do with sort of fighting things like congestion that might occur. Traffic congestion is something that planners are worried about. Does this report talk at all about things like the inversion that comes from, you know, cars on the road and the health implications for the people who will be showing up here or who are already here for that matter?
Right. They're trying to cut down on people driving because of the extra pollution, extra congestion. That's why they want people living in multi-family housing and living closer and using more mass transit. Without that, they see this big urban sprawl and people driving further and more congestion, more pollution, more water usage. So,
Robert Gerke, growth is coming. I mean, it's
growth
already here,
coming,
and
yeah.
It's, here comes some more. It generally seems like the smart thing to do is spend in advance, but the skeptic in me has to wonder, you know, if big spending isn't, you know, occasionally about handouts by the state legislature to its buddies.
Right, and that's part of what I wonder about too. I mean, I like the idea of planning. I think it's a good idea that we plan ahead instead of try to, you know, react after the fact. But you know, it is a little disconcerting because this money is going to have to come from somebody, and chances are that means that the rest of us might end up having to pay for so people in Draper can get some better development. Now we all benefit from that. You know, the air quality is probably a big thing. We've got 500,000 people that are going to be moving into the Wasatch Front by 2040. And so I think, you know, we need to make sure we need to start thinking about how we deal with that, how we move people around. But yeah, this is a lot of money. And I think people need to be aware and invested in it and recognize that, you know, you may end up having to pay for somebody else's roads down there. And you know, hopefully we all get a benefit from that.
Lee Davidson, some predictions about the number of people we're told will be flooding into this area by year. It's something like $57,000 or 57,000 people per year. Is that correct?
Well, that's statewide.
Yeah.
But that area, I can't remember the number, but state officials say that will be the epicenter for growth in the state.
Yeah.
That area of northern Utah County, southern Salt Lake County is expected to attract a lot of people. There's 20,000 acres of undeveloped land there that they think will totally fill in.
Right. And yeah, like I said, about the numbers from the Wasatch Front Regional Council are about 500,000 by 2040 along the Wasatch Front. And as Lee said, that's going to be the highest density growth. And, you know, with this prison relocation, this prison redevelopment, you know, they're looking at moving a lot of jobs, a lot of commercial space in there. And so that draws a lot of traffic. So
this is part of the Silicon Slopes idea. I mean, having development along those lines.
They want to concentrate that there, and they want, you know, I mean, the state, to the extent that it's making a play for the new Amazon headquarters, they're looking at that as a possibility there. You know, there's a number of possibilities when you have that much open space in an urban area with pretty good transportation options and it's an attractive place to put an office complex.
Okay. Well, again, Lee, people can comment on this. There's public comment periods open at the website. Will you remind us the website one more time?
It was pointofthemountainfuture, all one word, .org.
Okay. Guys, we are out of time, and we have to turn now to our underplayed stories of the week. And, we don't have to be too quick, but Lee, I'll give you a first option on this. What's your pick for underplayed story of the week?
The state came out with new population estimates this week. We gained another 50,000 people. That's like plopping in another Taylorsville. The more fascinating part of that is that what's driving that growth is changing. It used to be just big families and lots of babies, but we are on a 9-year consecutive slide in that. Meanwhile, migration and immigration has been picking up, and that accounts for a bigger share. So Utah's changing.
Okay, Utah's changing. Underplayed story of the week from Lee Davidson. Robert Gricke, let's go to you for your pick.
I'm going to do two. We'll do it quick. The first one is about a story that Lee did. Lee wrote like 40 stories this week, I think. But this is a story Lee did about the change, proposed changes to the governance of UTA. And, you know, UTA's had its share of problems, more than its share of problems over the last decade. And now there is the state task force that is looking at ways to sort of revise the governance. And they're looking at, instead of a 16-member board, which was unwieldy and unresponsive and didn't really do its job, they're looking at going to 3 full-time commissioners and appointed by the governor, which sort of brings the entire notion of the Utah Transit Authority more into the state's realm rather than making its own independent entity. And that's going to be a big fight, I think, during the upcoming legislative session. So that's something people want to pay attention to.
Okay.
And then the second one is, after 15 years on the job, Salt Lake Chamber President Lane Beatty announced his retirement yesterday. And so he's a former Senate president. He's been the chamber president since the Olympics, basically. And yeah, now he's hanging it up. So it's he was an institution in the city, and I think we'll probably be missed in that job.
Okay. Courtney Tanner, your pick for Underplayed Story of the Week.
I'll highlight kind of a quirky one. Luke Ramseth did this story about how University of Utah, biologists, I guess, are studying this venom of marine snails as an alternative to opioid painkillers.
Marine snails filling in for your struggle with addiction. Interesting pick. I'm going to go with Saboteurs of Journalism. That's my underplayed story of the week. Not all that underplayed, but you may have seen the sting operation by a group that was trying to entrap Washington Post reporters for secretly using a secretly recorded video. The idea was to get them to take an explicit stance on the subject that they were covering, and the reporters didn't go for the bait, and so kudos to them. But Lee Davidson wrote a story about the group behind these sting videos to take down these journalists fundraising here in the state of Utah, despite the fact that they're not allowed to do so. The Utah Division of Consumer Protection refused to renew the group's charity status here after the group's head, this guy James O'Keefe, was convicted of what the state division called a crime involving moral turpitude for another secret video incident. Anyway, Lee Davidson's story on this story is in your... thing is in your morning paper, or you can find it at sltrib.com. You can check it out. A quick comment that a listener called in to say that Jenny Wilson was not on the Salt Lake County Council during the time that the decision on the Rail Salt Lake Stadium was made. So a correction there. I checked it out, and it seems to check out. So
thank you.
Thanks very much, listeners, for calling in. All right, Lee Davidson, Robert Gricke, Courtney Tanner, all from the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining us today.
Thank you. Have a good weekend.
And thanks to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW, who makes the radio that you're hearing possible. Thanks to our partners at UPR in Logan, who broadcast this show across the state. That includes Tom Williams, Spencer Hulsey, Alyssa Roberts, and Christy Aachen. Thanks as well to the show's producer, Emily Means. You can find podcasts of this show and all of the rest of our local programs at kcpw.org. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks for joining us on the program. We'll see you again next week.
As you know, President Trump will be in Utah on Monday to announce reductions to Grand Staircase, Escalante, and Abarazir's National Monuments in Utah. Speculation is that those will be drastic reductions in size. I've already gotten a couple of emails and know that you will likely want to respond to these moves. We're going to devote Access Utah on Tuesday to this topic. We'll have some guests, but mostly we want to hear from you. You can email us right now to upraccess@gmail.com, and you can call in during the hour, 9 to 10 on Tuesday.
So you and your brain have a kind of quiet agreement to just get along.
Yeah, but every so often, you and your brain fall out of agreement.
My face just started to feel a little bit strange.
I felt the floor sort of shake.
I couldn't move.
The premonition that something's about to happen. And then boom.
When Brains Attack on the next Radiolab.
Join us tomorrow at noon on Utah Public Radio.
This is Utah Public Radio, a statewide service of Utah State University and the College of Humanities and Social Sciences. KUSR Logan, KUSK Vernal, KUSL Richfield, KUST Moab, KCEU Price, and KUSU FM Logan. Also heard online at upr.org.